Welcome. Thank you for attending session 175, titled Mormon Women and Alternative Spiritual Practices. Welcome to the closing evening session for Thursday. We remind you that following this session, there will be a dinner break, and then you are welcome to return for an evening devotional in the Crimson View Room. Thank you for attending the first full day of Sunstone. We hope you have enjoyed your day so far. This session is being recorded, and you will be able to purchase it after the presentation ends at the registration desk on the main floor. Please silence your cell phones and remain respectful. If you hear things that are challenging to you or that you disagree with, we ask you to practice what your brothers and sisters of the community of Christ call faithful disagreement. This means that you respectfully disagree while practicing empathy for the opposite point of view. At Sunstone, we recognize there are more than one way to Mormon, and this means every life and experience is unique and should be honored with respect to how someone experiences their Mormonism. We invite all of you to help build a world where the richness of diversity is celebrated and empathy becomes a daily practice. This session is 90 minutes long, and we ask both the audience and presenters to keep within the framework so that folks can get out to dinner on time. About this presentation, in recognition of the gendered nature of spiritual authority within the institutional Mormonism, many Mormon women have sought increased representation by seeking female ordination and encouraging further discussion of the divine feminine. Outside of institutional channels, many have also begun to look toward alternative practices to harness the power of God in their lives. These practices include immersion ceremonies, blessings, and devotion to Heavenly Mother. Using ethnographic methodologies, this paper seeks to understand the nature of these practices and the continued invocation of women's historic spiritual authority and the lives on contemporary Mormons. Doe Daughtry has a PhD in religious studies and is a full-time instructor at Arizona State University. Her dissertation included an analysis of the relationship of Mormonism to reincarnation and the ways in which some LDS women incorporate that concept into various hybrid spiritualities. Christina Rossetti is a doctoral candidate in the Department of Religious Studies at the University of California, Riverside. Her research focuses on the intersection of Mormonism and spiritualism, with particular attention to alternative forms of Mormon religious practice. Deborah Brown Gordy is a relationship therapist and spiritual development mentor. From her professional beginnings over 30 years ago as a BYU marriage and family therapist to the present time, she believes that the path for women towards spiritual progression, growth, healing, and transformation and empowerment lies in seeking the divine feminine.
Okay. In 2012, I graduated with a doctorate in religious studies, having written a dissertation about LDS women who create hybrid spiritualities, combining Mormonism with contemporary women's spirituality. In that project, I focused on women who accept channeled messages as further light and knowledge, leading them toward eternal progression as gods, those who practice and consume energy work to heal their various experiences of trauma and try to make a deeper sense out of Mormonism, and others who adopt and adapt earth-centered paths, frankly a code word for contemporary pagan, as another way of reacting to their lack of institutional power or authority. Channeling has as its Mormon analogy continuing revelation and the individual mandate to seek it. Some of the channeled products that are most popular in the U.S. include A Course in Miracles, promoted most heavily by Marianne Williamson, the Romtha materials, the source of the wildly popular What the Bleep Do We Know film, and the Abraham materials, the source of the best-selling book and film The Secret. Energy work, of course, has priesthood power and authority as its Mormon analogy. Reiki was the most widely practiced and consumed healing modality among those I interviewed for my dissertation, but chakra healing, rapid eye therapy, RET, and spiritual response therapy were also very popular. There are innumerable modalities, energy healing modalities. Almost all the women I worked with used energy work to resolve recalcitrant problems that priesthood blessings and prayer, all of those things that we are used to using in the Mormon toolbox, could not touch. Almost always the symptoms left behind after sexual abuse, rape, domestic violence, and the sense of powerlessness over their environments and lack of self-trust that was the result of emotional and spiritual abuse. Though both of these alternative streams often lead women to a deeper connection with Heavenly Mother, LDS women who engage in earth-centered practices are most often explicitly seeking that connection. Women's spirituality with capital letters is explicitly goddess-centered, for instance, with the obvious Mormon analogy being eternal progression toward godhood and the existence of a heavenly mother who is our role model. I found that a Mormon woman looking for further light and knowledge in a church that has systematically stripped its curricula of depth and substance and apparently is reluctant to proclaim any new substantive revelation can easily find herself looking toward channeled materials that lead her away from the, quote, orthodox Mormon life, though we all might do battle over what actually constitutes an orthodox Mormon life. More problematic still for maintaining Mormon identity is the earth-centered thread, whether that involves agitating for women's ordination due to a hunger for institutional equity, or the experience of being the person blessing the bread and water and performing the blessings instead of just passively accepting and consuming them. Once a woman has participated in and officiated over earth-centered ceremonies, Mormon identity becomes much more arduous. These women were less likely than all the others to stay engaged in the church. The women I worked with who engaged in energy work were most likely to be able to maintain a faithful, i.e. institutionally legitimate, Mormon identity, just so long as they distinguished their work from priesthood and did not present themselves as having priesthood power or authority. Of course, some met opposition from their local leaders, and holistic conference workshops then developed to aid LDS women in discussing their practices with their bishops and stake presidents so as to avoid local controversy and keep their temple recommends. Those who committed to studying and putting into practice the ideas and ideals of channels were by definition seekers. Well, all of these women are seekers, which Colin Campbell defines as, quote, someone who is likely to see some truth in all alternatives while regarding the movement from one doctrine or practice to the next as a genuine advancement in spiritual understanding and enlightenment, end quote. And unfortunately for the LDS Church, seeking is an activity that does not easily go quiet. I'm going to share with you one important story which did not make it into my dissertation because of how it illustrates the development of an alternative Mormon spiritual identity. This woman, Gloria, she's now in her 80s. Her ancestors were among the first members of the LDS Church. Her mother's father was polygamous. They lived in Mexico. They were driven out in the revolution with Pancho Villa and never went back to Mexico. With a few hiccups along the way, she says her family were, quote, very, very active in the church. Their lives revolved around it, even though Mormons were in the minority in the area they lived in around Phoenix. Literally, from the time she was 12, she says, her life revolved around ward, stake, and school. She said she, quote, used to be a law-oriented person, a young woman with no problems being obedient to the gospel. She ultimately married a convert from Idaho who her father taught the gospel after she met him. Quote, we talked about how to live the gospel and how we would live in our family when we married, but he just wasn't able to do it. He had so many hidden emotional problems that I had no experience with growing up in the 50s. As naive as I was and in the environment I was in, we didn't see a lot of emotional issues. I had no experience with it. 2 days after they were married, they were leaving to go to Idaho to visit his family, and during that two-day period, he, quote, literally reverted into a Mr. Hyde. Before we even reached Idaho, I was thinking, what have I done? Who is this man? 2 years after the wedding, he was hospitalized and diagnosed with psychotic personality disorder, and she lived in what she called hell for the next 30 years. Quote, the most peace we had, she says, was maybe 2 weeks at a time, and then he would go for months, and then we'd have another couple of good weeks. So it was not an easy task to have 5 little kids and to have this husband who was acting out. He was having affairs, he was lying. It just went on and on and on. So Gloria went to her church leaders, but because of the nature of this particular disorder, none of them could even begin to comprehend that her husband was the monster that she described. She knew she had to find solutions for herself, and so she became a seeker in a new and different way. Quote, at one point, I literally made a covenant with the Lord that I would stay in the marriage, and I sought his help and guidance in raising my children. I didn't know what I was saying at the time, but I said, I will stay in this marriage, and if ever a time when the effects of it need to be healed or fixed, I will make a demand that healing happens. So I was dictating to God. So she sought out self-help books and psychology texts that were only marginally helpful, unfortunately, and then got the prompting to move in a different direction. Quote, I began noticing that there was material in Eastern philosophy and occult sections of bookstores, so I would kind of very quietly, secretly almost, check out, read through it, and glean what I could. When her youngest child, a son, turned 19, he refused to go on a mission unless she divorced his father because he was so frightened to leave her alone with him. So she did. During this process, her daughters confessed to her that their father had sexually abused them. Quote, "So I went to God at that point and said, if I didn't protect my children and this actually happened to them, show me how to fix it or you take my life." She said, "Because we had been through so much for so long, I was given a vision at that time," she said, "and I was told to write it down. I was told that in the pre-existence, I had agreed to act as a link between past and future generations in the cleansing in the blood of those who lived on earth when they did not have the gospel nor understand the mission of the Savior. It was primarily with German ancestry, and my husband is half German. I had agreed to this," she said, "and I knew I'd had a confirmation he was the person I was to marry. I was also told that the children who were to come into this union had been well prepared and were a part of this cleansing. The father knew that my husband possessed all of the good and all of the bad of his past generations, and he would probably choose to magnify the evil. Those were the words I was given. In his family line, it had funneled down to him. He was the only boy to carry on that particular family name. So he was given through the gospel to refine those negative qualities that came through genetically. I was also given to understand at that time that when we come into this physical body, we're not just creating our own stuff, that we are taking on the genetics and experiences of our ancestors from both sides of our family. And this clearing, this cleansing that we were both to do was to clean up the DNA in those bloodlines. I was told that it had narrowed down to my husband, and my last child is my only son, that he had been put in place so that if my husband didn't complete this cleansing, it would fall upon him and any sons that he had to carry out that cleansing so that the cleansing could be done. I didn't know how that would be, how it was to happen. I didn't understand the message at the time. I didn't know about cell memory or the significance of all I was being given, but it gave me the momentum to look for other techniques outside of conventional psychology," end quote. So she went on to study rapid eye therapy. She studied with Carolyn Meese and other prominent energy workers around the country. When I asked her how this affected her relationship to Mormonism, she replied, "What I found was that as I began doing this work, I realized how fear-based and how rigid Mormons are in their law orientation, that they miss the principle of the law. I've never indulged in picking apart specific doctrines, but I discovered that whoever was speaking, I was hearing their level of spiritual development. They were teaching and interpreting scripture according to their own level of spiritual development. I could no longer take everything I heard as truth. What I found is that my journey in life became very solitary, very alone, because I had a whole different vocabulary." Excuse me. So the church plays a completely different role in her life now. She described an insight she had a few weeks before our discussion. Quote, "I took my bottle of water and I was holding it in my hand. I blessed my food and expressed gratitude, and I was holding the bottle and shaking it, instructing the water to perform or transform into the molecules the frequency I wanted for that day. As I was doing that, I literally heard somebody repeating the sacrament prayer to me. I thought, oh gosh, that's interesting. What are you trying to tell me? I do have a very close association with angels. I was given to understand the power within the sacrament prayer and the instructions that are literally to change the molecules within the bread and water to the Christ energy that can remain with us for a week when we truly, with the right attitude, take that sacrament." Wow. Blew me away. However, all of this knowledge has come at a cost for her. She says, "It's very impersonal at church. It's become that because I believe I'm an enigma to people. They don't know how to react to me. I'm friendly, and I don't bring up controversial things. I think they sense something about me they don't understand. Now, I'm considerate, so I try not to put people in those positions. As for me personally, it used to be when I was growing up and raising my family, the church was a great deal of our social life. I do not have really any connections per se with friends. I do my visiting teaching. The bishop speaks to me when it's convenient. I think I'm a mystery to him. He doesn't know what to say to me. I don't always give the pat answers, but I give them simply. I have to be truthful within myself, but I don't have to divulge everything. The church is no longer the scaffolding that holds my testimony or the social part that holds my internal values together. It's me that does it. I do that with Heavenly Father's Spirit. I don't walk a fear-based life so much anymore. If I go into doubt, I ask myself, okay, what are you manifesting here? Do you feel unsafe, that you're fearful, or do you have doubts? And I look at those so I can realign myself with faith. So it's a very personal, I call it a solitary thing. It's between me and God. Now, I organize all the classes I teach by some basic but vital categories: religious identity, power and authority, authenticity and legitimacy, human bodies, and evolution and adaptation. In terms of identity, the Mormon women that we're here to discuss today identify in some way as LDS, which means their engagement with alternative practices is at least to some extent informed by their experience of Mormonism. Whether they yearn for a connection with Heavenly Mother or reject her as a negative image meant to lull them in complacency and reinforce gender norms, I still call them seekers. In addition, they are seekers in the Mormon sense in that they are seeking after further enlightened knowledge, whether or not it has anything to do with the Mormon paradigm. And they understand very well the institutional Mormon structures of power and authority. While they are locked out of them at the highest levels, I mean, after all, just how many LDS women will serve on the General Relief Society board, especially if they're women of color? They still take seriously the mandate to serve and develop their talents. And to be fair, many of them are not convinced that those institutional structures are ordained by God. So even if they've rejected institutional structures, they are clearly asserting their own power and authority as children of the gods, Mormon gods or not, or no gods at all, to act, to be active in the world. They certainly experience challenges to their legitimacy, the legitimacy of their extra-Mormon commitments and practices. And fellow church members are inclined to censor them. And the church itself appeared in 2016 to remind them that there is an order to things, and it is found only in institutional power and authority structures, when church spokesman Eric Hawkins told KUTV News, quote, "We urge church members to be cautious about participating in any group that promises, in exchange for money, miraculous healings, or that claims to have special methods for accessing healing power outside of properly ordained priesthood holders," end quote. So it is clear that many other Mormons are likely to challenge our women's claims to authentic Mormon identity. Nevertheless, they find ways of legitimizing themselves, and their public identities evolve as they do. I believe, as does Grant McCracken, that identity is not established mainly by way of repetition, continuity, sameness, but by transformation. McCracken says, and I hope you get the significance of his insight for the women we're discussing and can see it in Gloria's story that I just shared with you, quote, "Transformation used to be what the gods did to one another. Now it is what we do to ourselves." Transformation, he says, can be obsessive, a collective undertaking, part of larger social change, a course of creativity and innovation, other words for adaptation. It can be a release from disability and constraints, like, for instance, when he uses singer-songwriter Michelle Schacht as an example who, quote, "never hesitates to escape from her Mormon past, from the categories of race, gender, and music, from her paternalistic record company," end quote. Sometimes transformation captures us and moves us along because we are simply curious. But it is also revelatory, such as when we reveal our private selves in public space, when we admit the truth about ourselves, whatever that is, when we come out as gay, as women of color no longer willing to stay quiet, as doubters or non-believers, as goddess worshipers, as angry women. Transformation speeds up then when we add ritual to that process of identity evolution. Scholars of religion have long debated whether there is any freedom in ritual. McCracken and others say no, that if the individual is allowed to improvise or innovate, those actions strip ritual of its legitimacy, because after all, ritual is legitimized by referring to its antiquity, right? We've always done it that way, right? In Mormonism, it's easy to see. Temple rituals are authorized by their association with restored priesthood authority and legitimized by claims that they are essentially the same rites practiced by Adam and Eve, the first authentic humans. Whenever the church has evolved its doctrines or changed its rituals, insider outcries usually follow for those very reasons. So if institutional innovations are suspect, individual creativity is surely satanic, right? I argue, however, that there is tremendous ritual freedom in reinterpreting a ritual's meaning, just as certainly as it is in choosing which rituals we participate in. Yes, energy work has boundaries, too, and instructions and ritual ways in which those modalities are meant to be performed, and many professional and certifying organizations exist to police those boundaries. Yet even Reiki has evolved into numerous versions. The will to innovate appears to be inherent to human beings. So doing a little research to prepare for this panel, it appears to be that not much has changed since I defended my dissertation in 2012, except for maybe the numbers. If their self-reported statements are to believe, more LDS women, meaning women I've never heard of, and this is my world, my specialty, are doing these things. If they are still engaged in the LDS church, the divine feminine is high on their lists. Having heavenly parents, specifically a heavenly mother, developing a relationship to her, with her, praying to her, pursuing that further light and knowledge about her, resisting the institution's designations for her, appear to be all highly important to them. Erasing gender binaries from their Mormon practice is important to them. They read tarot cards, practice energy work, give their children and each other blessings, and so on. It may be that because these practices and ideas are even more mainstream and available to them. And, of course, women of color have mujerista and womanist and indigenous practices that are available to them that they are reclaiming and practicing. Energy workers and training in innumerable healing modalities are incredibly accessible, and it's just about as easy to join a pagan meetup group or identify like-minded women to develop a private moon circle or hold a blessing way. Most of these practices used to be called New Age, which has long been dismissed as shallow and trivial, and perhaps the worst slur that could be slung at it was that it was made up. Made up. Unlike authentic, legitimate Christianity, right? Which notably has tens of thousands of variations, so there's got to be some making up in there somewhere, right? But commitment to alternative practices can be anything but vacuous or shallow or trivial. Our women must also grapple with the myths their practices are based on and through which they are legitimized. Do they still believe in the Joseph Smith story? And if so, which story might that be? Do they still believe it, even in the Judeo-Christian story? Do they believe in the matriarchal myth? What do they believe about magic? Healing, where does that come from if they're the ones doing it? How does what we now know from quantum physics change their view of all the above paradigms? Regardless, unless you think I forgot the remaining category, all religion as it is enacted by human being is embodied. No religious experience is possible without a body and a functioning brain. In that sense, then, all religion is created by humans because it does not exist outside of human beings who interpret, enact, and deploy it. And the search for healing and equity undertaken by the women we are discussing is definitely an embodied search. McCracken's speech speaks of transformational routines, and we are all well acquainted with the transformational routines that the church brings to bear on the bodies of girls and boys to transform them into faithful and believing adults. And there is no denying that many, maybe even most members, find those rituals or routines empowering. But stepping outside those routines and learning new ones involves the embodied evolution of how we relate to and communicate and interact with both others and ourselves. Sets us on a completely different evolutionary trajectory. As Meredith McGuire says, quote, if they are at all effective, embodied practices are hardly neutral, end quote. While much ritual is meant to produce disciplined and docile bodies, and we see how that works in Mormonism, the practices these women are committed to and all of these alternative practices involve rituals or are ritualistic, are meant to challenge and heal racism, gender bias, inequities, poverty, war, ableism, and numerous other inequities. They are not vacuous. They are not shallow. Spiritual activism alters, transforms bodies. We dress differently, we use different language, we walk differently, and the content of our talk shifts. Just because founding myths are not ancient, or they are deliberately eclectic or adaptive, does not render them shallow or vacuous or trivial. Grappling with power, authority, authenticity, and legitimacy takes deep commitment. Regardless, even if we ignore or dismiss the alternative spiritual practices LDS women are drawn to, we will not miss the revolution, because it is here and it will not retreat or go away. Thank you.
Hi. You're going to hear a similar quote by the church office. It's great. Because it was all over the news. All right. So in April 2016, a document emerged. It was leaked, if you're interested in that, right down the hall. Ryan Chittister is talking about it. From the state president's office in central Utah that indicated a concern for five individuals who were being led astray and causing others to wander. Two of these individuals are reported as having confessed to their bishops of actions leading to apostasy. Although the potential to fall into a state of apostasy by joining a sectarian Mormon movement, in big quotes, was the primary concern of church leadership, a secondary concern was expressed in the document that was slightly more complex. The church document suggests a gateway drug which leads people to join, that's an actual quote in the document, there's a gateway drug, that leads people to join sectarian and fundamentalist movements. This drug is holistic healing, energy treatments, and herbalism. The document gives one specific incident of these practices as an example. Quote, the family was struggling with a son who had emotional issues and wasn't sleeping at night. The secondary family introduced them to energy treatments and showed them how to use prayer to shield their son from the influence of the adversary. The treatments worked and led the family to trust this group even more. End quote. The incident cited in this document reveals similar trajectories across a number of families. Each incident begins with a woman participating in spiritual practices that fall outside the scope of contemporary LDS religiosity. The concern over women exercising religious authority to bless and heal was further expressed in April 2016 when the church released an official statement on such practices in response to a retreat in southern Utah marketed toward empathic women in Mormon communities. The spokesperson for the church, Eric Hawkins, stated, "We urge church members to be cautious about participating in any group that promises, in exchange for money, miraculous healings, or that claims to have special methods for accessing healing power outside of properly ordained priesthood holders." And the emphasis there is on an exchange for monetary compensation, and it is important to note that a lot of the women going to these retreats and a lot of the women that I spend time with and interview are actually not charging money, so that's something to consider. From the LDS Church's statement, the practice of healing only constituted a genuine concern when done outside of traditional methods of the priesthood, which is inherently gendered. Fast forward 3 months to June 2016. I found myself doing laundry, as one does, at my apartment in Utah. I had spent the week in the church history library reading accounts of Mormon spiritualism and doing fieldwork at local meeting houses. As I knelt in the laundry room, the front door of the basement opened, and a woman in her 30s named Zina walked through the door. She looked down and asked who I was. I shared that I had just moved to Utah for the summer. I didn't know anyone. It was awful. From California, and I was researching Mormonism. At this remark, she was so excited, and she said, "I'm Mormon." In a moment of poor judgment, it was a long week. It was rough. I responded by telling her that that was fine, and it was well, and it was all great and everything, but I was interested in Mormons who do alternative spiritual practices, specifically accounts of Mormon spiritualism. Without missing a beat, she looked at me and responded, "Oh, I do that." I stared at her, unable to form words, as she explained that she met with a group of women on a regular basis, women who were mediums and healers and empaths, women who spoke to their heavenly mother and had personal relationships with those who had passed over to the other side of the veil. After a brief conversation, she was sure that I had been sent to her and invited me to participate in her women's group for the remainder of the summer. The women met in a rented space of an apartment complex in central Utah on Sunday evenings. At the first meeting I attended, the women began by sitting in a circle and introducing themselves to all the new attendees. Each of the women comes from a Mormon background and was raised within the LDS church. And I want to note that the women that I spend time with are all active LDS. They have callings in the church. They all go to the temple weekly. As the women move through their introductions, they share various stories that led them to this group for this particular meeting.
One woman shared that she had just experienced a miscarriage and was so grateful for the small necklace she received in the group meeting the week before that she could not wait to come back. Everyone's eyes shifted to the delicate chain around her neck with a circular pendant at the bottom. The pendant was a small tree made of neatly woven crystals. She had prayed in the midst of her anguish and asked God to allow Heavenly Mother to bless the necklace and infuse it with her presence. It has become both a great comfort in her life and a means of reconnecting with her heavenly parents. The woman next to her began to cry as she explained that she is newly pregnant, but finds herself angry with God and unsure how it's going to affect her pregnancy. Currently, she is working toward reconciliation and a renewed relationship with her Heavenly Mother. This relationship, which was common among the women, as you noted, manifests in the frequent singing of a pagan hymn poem reimagined as a Mormon hymn directed toward Heavenly Mother. And it goes, "The river is flowing, flowing and growing, the river is flowing down to the sea. Mother, carry me, your child I will always be. Mother, carry me down to the sea." The meeting of the women in Utah recalls the broader Mormon story of women gathered as a kingdom of priests bound by spiritual authority to bless, heal, and perform ordinances. And many of these women were very clear in saying that this meeting was their relief society. Despite institutional suspension, women in these groups continue the Mormon practice of female-led ordinances. The hymn to Heavenly Mother sung during the first gathering of women I attended gained increased importance toward the end of the summer as the women of the group gathered for an immersion ceremony. Driving up the mountains, Eliza shared about growing up in the church and what led her to attend this particular event. Eliza was raised in Utah, grew up active in the church, attended BYU, married a returned missionary in the Manti Temple, and is currently raising 3 young children. She explained how everything was in order, it was all fine and well, until she learned about the Battle Creek Massacre. She recalled learning of indigenous women huddled together in the snow with their children as members of the Mormon militia stormed a Shoshone encampment in response to a horse theft. She had never learned the story in her seminary institute classes. Her newfound interest in history led her to further investigate church history, where she uncovered stories such as Mountain Meadows Massacre, but more importantly, the lives of the women of the church. The woman in the passenger seat of the car, I was sitting in the back, began to weep as the car drove onward toward the river. She had a similar Mormon upbringing and was also working through a relationship with the institutional church. The river is set against a green backdrop and carries the cold runoff from the snow at the top of the mountains. As we approached the small grove near the entrance of the river, we were met with women changing into the clothes they would wear for the ceremony. Sylvia is one such woman. She is in her 40s and has dark black hair and a really tall frame. She's really tall. She's active in the church and attends the temple weekly to participate in endowment sessions. She is also one of the great-granddaughters of John Taylor, which is probably, I think, the coolest thing about her. She's super proud of that fact. She pulls out the dress she chose to wear for the ceremony. It's a long-sleeve white dress that grazes the floor. It has no beading or elaborate ornamentation. She shares that it's her temple dress, the one she wears weekly to the Salt Lake City Temple to perform sacred ordinances for her ancestors. For Sylvia, as with other women present, the immersion ceremony for which they brought white clothes was sacred as the experiences in the temple and worthy of the same attire. Rather than compartmentalize this event as distinct from their Mormon identity, the language and clothing surrounding the event is framed as uniquely Mormon. As we change, the women continue their conversations on church history, including the rebaptisms that occurred during the Mormon Reformation under Brigham Young. Although the LDS Church no longer practices such practices, the immersion in the river refers back to this Mormon principle and the history of the church that lingers in the air near the river. The women walk toward the river and slowly step into the cold water. Slowly they move together and stand arm in arm in a circle to stabilize each other in the midst of the rushing water. So the water is really powerful in this river, and so everyone stood in a big circle and like held on to each other. And it was a really beautiful picture because people brought their children, especially young children, and so children were present and women were helping to hold each other's babies as they were undergoing this ritual. So without prompting, the women began to sing to Heavenly Mother with joy and tears in their eyes. One by one, women entered into the circle. The women share brief stories about their journey into this space and ask a particular woman to help guide her into the water. In some instances, all the women in the circle lay hands onto the woman entering the water as if to offer a blessing and confirm the sacred nature of the event taking place. Mary, a woman I had met this summer, enters into the circle and calls to her friend Hannah to help her into the water. A year earlier, Hannah had helped deliver and bless Mary's child. Hannah holds Mary by the hand while also drawing her face, while drawing their faces close to one another so her blessing can be heard over the sound of the water. Over the background, noise from the scenery murmurs, as you can vaguely hear phrases such as being a daughter of God and a commemoration of Heavenly Mother. As Hannah tilts Mary into the water, Hannah clearly states, "Mary, today I baptize you." Hannah begins to cry as she is lowered into the water and emerges to cheering and the embraces of other women participating in the sacred ordinance of that Saturday afternoon. To onlookers, and there were onlookers and glares and people throwing things, the priesthood was not present in the river that flowed through Utah that day. However, for many of these women, the spiritual authority needed to perform sacred ordinances is usurped by the spiritual power they gain through simply being a child of heavenly parents. One woman, Patty, is in her late 60s. She's a medium and has a gift of speaking with angels and spirits that emerge from the other side of the veil to comfort the living. Mediumship is not an explicitly Mormon practice. In fact, general authorities, beginning under the leadership of Brigham Young, have cautioned against engaging with mediumship. However, beginning with Joseph Smith's lectures on the nature of spirits and matter, as well as the possibility of working on behalf of the dead, Mormonism has a long history of people communicating with the deceased in the walls of the temple for both comfort and spiritual insight. For Patty, her spiritual gifting is centrally Mormon, and the ability to communicate with the spirits was revealed to her by God during her patriarchal blessing. When I first met Patty, she was sitting in my neighbor's home reading the spirits of the general authority. She believes that she has the spiritual insight and authority to determine whether they are the good men of God that they claim to be. As she looks over an image of the church leaders, she points to each one and offers her spiritual insight. She's pleased to announce specifically that Elder Holland is one of the good ones. Although she did not know at the time, mediumship and energy channeling were the gifts referred to in her blessing that she received as a child. She believes that she has divine confirmation for her work and the work of her women's group because of the blessing that she was given. And she was told that she would have power over the elements and that she would be a great and righteous leader in the midst of Zion. Following the immersion in the river, the women returned to the rented apartment space that became a staple throughout the summer. We met there every week on Sunday. While sharing a meal, the women spoke of their experience that day and how they felt leaving the water. Eliza, who spoke in the car of learning church history and seeking spiritual guidance elsewhere, continued to share some of her story. She explains that despite her sadness and feelings toward the institutional church, she continues to attend sacrament meeting every Sunday. She will be in attendance the morning after her rebaptism. Her husband currently serves as the elders' quorum president, and he also works at BYU. So there's economic concerns to her leaving the church. For Liza and her husband, an inactive status was simply not an option. Following the first hour block of church, Eliza usually takes her children outside for the remainder of the meeting and reads to them. She no longer participates in Sunday school or Relief Society. So for her, as with a lot of these other women, this Sunday night gathering is her Relief Society. When asked what the ordinance in the river meant to her, she elaborates on the discussion she had on the drive to the river, on the history of the church, her ancestors, the place of women, and her heavenly parents. Thinking through these themes that pervade the minds of all the women in the room, she states, "I have been haunted all day, but now I feel free." In her work on eternal polygamy, Carolyn Pearson asserts that Mormon women are haunted by the specter of the principle of plural marriage, the visible invisible that appears time and again as a reminder of the past and a warning to future women as they enter into the sealing ordinance of marriage. I would suggest that just as women within the Restoration are haunted subjects, Mormonism is simultaneously haunted by its women and the specter of the spiritual authority they held in the early church. Early records of the church present a picture of women actively engaged in the work of healing, washing and anointing, laying of hands, organizing, and participating fully in temple ordinances. Within each of these callings and practices, the women of the church were preparing Zion and building the kingdom of God on earth. In each of these practices, the work they engaged in was not separate from the priesthood. Although the contemporary moment is rife with controversy over the nature of women's leadership and the extent to which they maintain spiritual power, women in Mormon movements continue to seek legitimization of their authority through interactions with a spectral past that lingers in the background of their meetings and the background of the river. Thank you.
I don't know what it is. Do you know what the same people is? Of course. Okay.
I mean, unless you don't want to.
I'm happy to.
Okay, my name is Deborah Brown Gordy, as I was introduced earlier, and I've known Donan for almost 30 years, and we just met today for the first time in person. I am one of, not one of the women in her study, but I was one of the women in her study, and Doe and I met through another study as well. And in addition to being a BYU-trained marriage and family therapist, I'm also one of those energy healing practitioners. I'm a Reiki practitioner. I'm a master rapid eye therapist. I am a soul detective healing practitioner. And my path to the divine feminine and through trusting the leading of God in my life has been the path that has led me along this way of embracing energy healing and receiving profound, profound blessings of transformation and growth and empowerment in my own life, and being privileged to facilitate that for others. So I really don't have a formal presentation to share with you, but I'm happy to answer questions. I'm happy to add some insight and perspective to what Donan and our other presenters already shared. And I'm happy to answer your questions. So,
is there a
stand?
Could you share that one to answer?
If we don't ask questions in the microphone, then it doesn't make it on the audio recording.
Well, I'd like to know about joy and beauty, and in other words, sometimes when people are forging new paths, there's anger, do you know what I mean, and bitterness, and what I am seeing a lack of in the general church experience is like joy and beauty, and so I'm just wondering how your experiences with these different things bring that to you, and what it feels like. Okay,
well, I'm happy to answer, and then I also want to share the mic with others as well. I think getting through the darkness is often a step in getting to the light. That's a principle, I think, that is inherent in our system and our understanding, whether it comes from the temple or whether it comes from the scriptures or life experience teaches us that. I think often as we're getting to the point of getting to joy and beauty and happiness and light and truth, there has to be a period of acknowledging the sorrow, the pain, the darkness, the trial of mortality. And that goes beyond, and especially in the age that we're in now. If this is the era of the restoration of all things, and I believe it is, and that era of the restoration of all things is preparatory to the millennial age, the messianic age, the age of the bringing it all together, then we are here, each one of us individually, to do a great work that Donan described in the client story that she shared, the story of Gloria, who was told that she married the man that she married with the horrible trial that she went through for all those years in her marriage, because she had a soul agreement with him that she and he together would have the opportunity to heal his family line. That is not unique. I believe for many of us, if not most of us, we all have a soul agreement that's cosmic, that's bigger than we are, in part because of the time in which we live. So oftentimes, the sorrow, the darkness, the despair, the anger, as we're on this journey, is more than our own. We are working it out and having the opportunity to heal some things that have been coming together and being potentized and getting bigger and bigger and bigger through the generations, many times for hundreds if not thousands of years, until we come to this point in time where we have this opportunity in this day to do this kind of work. Because the thing happens, when we don't heal it, whatever it is, three things happen. We heal it, ideally, or it carries forward in our own lives until we, and it keeps coming back around and around and around and around until we do say, okay, what is this? What is this telling me about myself? What is this telling me about my life? What is this telling me about my soul mission? So it comes around and around until we have the opportunity to say, okay, yes, I will do the work. Or we pass it on. And the story that Doe shared was a beautifully written illustration of how it grows often bigger and more difficult until some big soul says, okay, I will do it. And they step up and they do the work. So often, to answer your question, to get to joy and beauty and happiness and joy, the path to that is often through sorrow first. But I will say to you that even in the midst of the journey, there can be periods of profound, cosmic, indescribable, ineffable joy in the process. When you have that connection and you feel it coming through you and working through you in behalf of someone else or in behalf of your own life or those you love. So those are my thoughts.
I guess I just wanted to share very briefly, about a year and a half, one of my children died, my middle daughter died, and I spoke in the previous sessions, sitting at this table, about what I did, what my path looked like after that, you know, after the death of a child, what does your path look like? And one of the very first things I did was contact Gloria, because I was so desperate to find it, and I was already in a dark time because we'd had to move to California by locating from California to here and back and forth to help raise one of our grandchildren for about 9 months. Well, we were actually there for a year, but that lasted for about 9 months. And I was there when she died. Well, I was here. I'd just flown in for a faculty meeting, but I was not living here when she died, and so I hadn't seen her in a couple of weeks, and it was just a really terrible, traumatic experience. And so one of the very first things I thought of was to call her. And whereas my getting back on the path towards joy and beauty didn't happen in that instant, going to see her and seeking out other forms of energy work had a huge impact on my ability to just stay on the planet. And so, I mean, I can look back and see the beauty in that, and I can feel joy for the fact and gratitude for the fact that I knew her to call her, and you know, other people like that. But yeah, I mean, it's kind of like the stages of grief. When you make a shift, when you're transforming, it can be very painful, and you have to go through these stages. I think. I don't have any citation for that.
It's gonna break.
Awesome. So most of the time when I talk to, so I don't just focus on women, but when I talk to women specifically, most of them will often repeat the phrase that your joy is relative to your suffering. I mean, it's something that most people have heard in their life, that you understand joy because you've gone through suffering. It's why we know what joy is. And so they often talk about that's something that they understand, the joy they experience in in moments with the women that they're participating in, because they know what it's like not to have those experiences. But just to comment on joy and beauty in general, I don't come from a Mormon background. I just study Mormonism. And I always comment that one of the most beautiful and powerful religious experiences that I was ever able to participate in was in the river on that Saturday afternoon. Hands down, like, I'm Roman Catholic. We do a lot of rituals. It's great, but bar none, one of the most beautiful things I've ever done was standing in the river. It was freezing. It was horrendous. It was so cold. And singing that hymn that I read to you and watching women get baptized in the river, like, bar none, most beautiful thing I've ever seen.
I have to say something about your reading of that experience. It was so profound to hear you read that. And it is such an excellent example of how women have subverted, if I can use that word, subverted the story of eternal mother, or of, you know, what do they call it? The idea that women are born to be mothers, you know, the sacred motherhood, whatever you want to call it, you know, they've subverted that. Yes, for Mormon women, giving birth, at least in this century, has been framed as a sacred project, if you will. But this subverts that narrative and transforms it into something incredibly subversive, and yet validated, legitimized, authorized by referring to, the things they referred to. I can't remember if they referred to scripture, but by referring to personal revelation. That's what we're built on. And all of the women I worked with, they all authorized their practices and their beliefs through referring to revelations they had received. That is incredibly subversive.
And I'm going to ask you specifically to define subversive, because I think there's tremendous power in that word.
I get little thrills and chills when I say what I mean is that they're claiming it for themselves. And it's not just... It doesn't just mean that, yes, motherhood is sacred and that's all I get to do, which is what it was to me. I will never do or be anything in this life because I felt like I had to have a house full of kids. And I even got told that by someone at ASU. That was his explanation for why I couldn't get into the Med Enthro program. You have to have more to show for the last 20 years of your life than popping out a few kids. But these women... They're subverting that narrative by not just saying it's sacred, this is a sacred thing, but they're wresting the authority and the power away from institutional interpretations of what it means to have that power and authority, and they're using it to empower themselves. I don't know if I'm being very articulate, but that's what I mean when I say, you know, they're claiming Heavenly Mother, and they're claiming what motherhood, they're reinterpreting what motherhood means to them and what it means to be a child of God.
Absolutely. And it's also, in my profound and passionately held experience, part of the time in which we live, that more and more women, ordinary women, women that you would never guess from looking at them, are on this path of seeking this and feeling this hunger and this yearning and this need that will not be filled through an institutionalized, hierarchical, patriarchal, male-defined, and male-controlled system. There's a part of a woman's life, a part of her experience of herself, a part of her coming into her own spiritual maturity that only comes, in my opinion, and I guess I'm willing to be wrong, but I really don't think I am, that only comes when a woman is on this path. So this creativity that Doe referred to about motherhood, it's more than motherhood. And yes, I am a mother and a grandmother, and that is profoundly sacred and fulfilling and joyful for me. And there's a bigger role and a bigger presence and a bigger purpose for all of that. And I think that's what Mormon women, along with women of all kinds of paths in life, are feeling called to and a hunger for that isn't being filled any other way. And so the time in which we live, and I think it's specific to this time as part, literally, of the restoration of all things.
Kind of have a this is one of those like harder questions because we focused a lot on the positive aspects of this, and I definitely think that this is really beautiful. It's very empowering. This phenomenon of Mormon women participating in alternative, or what would be considered like alternative spiritual practices, it's discussed actually a lot within ex-Mormon atheist communities, as we have lots of family members who are like this, and we're like, wow, they're like really Mormon, but they also like are really in this Reiki stuff, a lot of times in atheist communities, we talk about it in very negative ways. We're like, Mormonism like made them susceptible to pseudoscientific claims. We're not emphasizing the positive aspects, the empowering aspects, the beautiful aspects. And I'm wondering if in some of your research and your experiences, if you've seen people going down certain paths that you were like, oh, that doesn't sound like a great idea. I'm just wondering about the negative aspects, whether they be pseudoscientific related or whether they be maybe controversies within the family and stuff like that.
So again, I'm not Mormon. I'm trained as an ethnographer, so I'm trained to hang out with people. It's hilarious. I went to school to learn how to hang out with people. So one of the things that I was taught most ardently in my anthropology and ethnography classes was the importance of suspending my disbelief, which is hard. Like, it's really hard to look at people and be like, oh, of course, that makes complete sense. And I always tell my students, because I'm teaching a class on death right now, and I always tell my students, the greatest thing you'll ever do in your life is go hang out with people that aren't like you. But there's like two ways to do that, right? You can either walk into a religious environment and be like, this is cool, but it's wrong. Or you can walk into a religious environment and be like, this is cool, tell me more about it. And so as an ethnographer, I really value the ability to walk into a room and listen to people and be like, yeah, that absolutely makes sense. Granted, I'm easily swayed by religion. I think it's the best. I think it's great. I'm really easily swayed by it. And feeling the feels of the religious environment that I'm in. But I think there's value to taking what people say at face value in a really real way, and looking at people who are doing these practices and saying, yeah, if you find this empowering, I'm not going to take that from you. I won't lie. There's absolutely moments that I look at a lot of practices specific to the groups that I'm working with that I think this could potentially become problematic. And there's some medical practices specifically that I've seen to be potentially a problem. In terms of spiritual practices, not so much, because I don't see those. I haven't seen them as potentially harmful. There have been medical practices that I've seen as being a potential problem. So I'm not going to, pretend that that's not there. But in general, I think that I conduct my research in a way that really values the principle of suspending disbelief and believing people when they say that this practice matters.
I'm kind of with her. I was also trained as an ethnographer. But I no longer, maybe 15 or 20 years ago, I started thinking of myself as a Mormon pagan because I was interested in the goddess. I was interested in Heavenly Mother. And then I did a year and a day with a coven, with an eclectic Wiccan coven, and I became a high priestess, and everything I did, I had to, and that was, I could have been talking about myself when I said, oh, you have to figure out what, ask yourself, what do I believe about magic? With a K, what do I believe about that? But I filtered everything through the Mormon lens. Well, now, when I had to fill this out, I just put pagan. And the Mormon has pretty much dropped away from me in terms of how I interpret the world, except for some obvious. My husband is a very believing Mormon member of the LDS Church, but I. Um, So there are times, like when I listen to the story, there's like a little bell ringing in my ear saying, well, that's wonderful that, you know, that they're doing all these things, but do they feel free to go get a master's degree? You know, or do they also feel free, you know, feel like it's within the realm of possibility for them to do other things besides be a mother? But that, you know, that's my hang up. That's because that was my fear. That was my worst thing imaginable. I haven't seen anything that with the women I've, you know, just because I am maybe an agnostic with regard to, for instance, what happens after we die, or, you know, what power, you know, whether the LDS Church, well, I'm not an agnostic when it comes to what I believe about the LDS Church. I'm not engaged. I'm a member of record, but I'm not, because of my husband, but I'm not engaged. And I don't see myself ever becoming engaged again, although I don't know, this is all pretty exciting. But, like, yeah, I want to be in that river. Let me. Can you like introduce me next time I'm in town? Let me come. I want to come. But it's not my. I don't consider it my right to. You know, everybody has a path. I mean, I think we become too concerned. I think in my past, I have become too concerned about other people and what they believe and what they do. Whereas I just think I need to just stop worrying about them. Now, if they want to reproduce gender stereotypes, that bothers me. But
I want to answer real quickly part of your question that I don't think has been addressed yet, and then I see some other hands. You asked about not just agnostic ideas or views about this kind of work, and you also talked about the downside or the cautions, or is it scientific? And I want to say to you, yes, it is. It's actually very scientific. It's actually based in hard science, physics, and about energy and matter, and the way we can learn to work with energy as a way to interface with the material world. And as I was studying my basic training in rapid eye technology and in soul detective healing in particular, the connection between the mysticism of it and what appears or can appear to someone who doesn't understand the science can look magical or magical thinking, is connected to the science of how it works. So there is that, and there's a growing body of research and professional organization for energy healing and energy psychology, and growing bodies of research that are helping bring that into the professional research field. So if somebody's interested to know more about that, please talk to me, and I'll be happy to give you some starting points.
So can you say a little bit about the intersection between Mormonism and reincarnation? I was really interested in that little blurb in the pamphlet.
Oh, yeah, I would have to pull up my dissertation and read you that part. And I presented here last year on that intersection. Almost, well, there might have been one person I interviewed who did not believe in reincarnation in some form, although she said, you know, I'm like really grappling with that now. But I mean, these women had you know, revelations, and so many that they weren't even seeking. It just suddenly like hit them like a ton of bricks all of a sudden. Wait a minute. You know, I mean, I've talked to many women who didn't make it into my, you know, dissertation who had personal revelation about reincarnation being true. And it does seem, I don't have the citations for you, I can't remember the names, but it does seem pretty clear that early Mormons grappled with this, and many of them did believe, okay, so you already know, all right. Okay. They grappled with this, and they did seem to believe, some of them, many of them maybe, in reincarnation. So I'm not entirely, since you know about that, what is it? Maybe I may have missed the point of your question.
No, just if any of the historical stuff was ready at hand if you knew of any of it.
No, I'm sorry. Okay. None of the historical stuff. Just that it's a very potent and important piece today. Apparently, 11%. Geez, Louise. It may sound like a paltry number, but there are a lot of Mormons in the U.S., and that's 11% is pretty darn significant in my book. It signals a sea change as far as I'm concerned. I don't remember the historical context. I'm sorry.
Outside of the church's official memo, how are active members navigating the risk of disciplinary actions for their energy and healing or alternative spirituality?
Especially if their personal revelation comes up against what their local leaders.
Yeah, well, sometimes their bishops take their temple recommends away, right? If they go in, see, because we feel compelled to go in, right? Or many of us do, certainly my generation, felt compelled to go in and talk to the bishop. I know that I just got a revelation that, well, here, give me your temple recommend. Nope, that's not right. That's, but I want to refer you to, you'll have to, the Mormon, there's a holistic conference of some kind that takes place here, and a few years ago, there were some workshops around how to talk to your stake president and how to talk with your bishop and how to navigate those waters. So I would refer you to the sources like that to find out what they've made available, and you could talk with.
Okay. I have perhaps a little bit different viewpoint about that. I have never, ever been questioned or challenged in any way by any church leader because of my professional work. And that may in part be because I do have my academic background on my professional training in marriage and family therapy, which I draw upon, which is part of my work. But I certainly don't hide the energy healing component to it. And in fact, I have my model, my theory of change, and the way I work with people and the methods that I use is an integrated, synthesized model. Because I'm able to present it in a way that builds the bridge between the science and the spirit. And I've never, ever, ever felt compelled to go talk to any priesthood leader about my work. Okay? And as a therapist, I have professional guidelines, I have ethics, I have boundaries of confidentiality that I am very clear about. I'm very passionate about holding those boundaries. And it's, frankly, not a church leader's role to be intruding into a client's relationship with me and the way they work with me. And I describe it very clearly and very comfortably, and I have an informed consent form that all of my clients read and freely choose to sign or not, that helps guide the way I work with them, that discusses energy psychology and methods. So I don't run into problems with it, and I've been involved in energy psychology for 15 years.
I also want to say that I think it depends on your demeanor, too, right? I mean, look at her, right?
You are.
I can't imagine anyone challenging you because you are absolutely self-assured. You are absolutely certain, and I just can't because of the way you are in the world, the way you move about in the world. I can't imagine that anyone would even consider challenging you. Now, not all women are like that. I didn't used to be like that. If we're afraid, she's not afraid of anything. When I was afraid, I was the one going in all the time. If women are afraid, then it's like something's tattooed, on your forehead, and people sense that. Your church leaders sense that. But if you're just like
So throughout my research, that has been a huge concern for a lot of the women that I talk to. So I do want to note that all the names are changed, and you will never know the river that we went to.
They were all famous Mormon women from the early church?
Yeah, so all the pseudonyms in my work are the wives of Joseph Smith, so now you know.
Yeah.
I know, it's great. Well, throws... What?
You'll never run out of names.
I know, I'll never run out of names. It's great. No, that was something that was actually by the request of a lot of the women, was to have the names of these women spoken and heard, so that's why I did that. But all of them are pseudonyms. And part of that, because a lot of people do ask me, where are these women? And I do have an open IRB, because I'm an ethnographer. I have an institutional review board approval, and part of it is the complete confidentiality of the women I study, where they're located, because if you know where they're located, you probably will be able to know what ward they go to, and you would know their bishop, and things can go awry. So, because that is a concern for the people I study. But it is mixed. But what I've found is most of the women did have a reaction of like, who is this woman with a notepad that hangs out with us now? Like, why does she always have a notepad? And that became a really big concern, because a lot of them do understand that there is a potential for disciplinary action. But most of them don't tell their families what they do. That most of the women I work with have not told their families what they do. And if they do, the backlash they've experienced has been from their immediate family. They haven't had any backlash from their bishop or stake president, but they have had problems with their families. So that's something to know.
By families, do you mean husbands?
Not always. Sometimes it's their kids. They're like, you know, moms, dads. A lot of the women that I'm working with are between the ages of 19 and 35, so they're really young in their life. They are all married, they all have kids, but they're all still relatively young.
I just wanted to know what modalities you use and why you chose those. What led you to those over others?
I'm happy to answer that question, because I actually have a missionary story about one of them. So my entrance into the modalities was I started getting involved in essential oils about 24, 25 years ago. And I've never been a guru groupie. Never, ever. So people around me started talking about essential oils and a particular Utah-based essential oil company and how wonderful they are and the leader. I did research about essential oils and the scientific efficacy of the essential oils and why they work. So that was the first modality, actually, that I started using. Then I, about 16, 17 years ago, became a Reiki master teacher in Colorado, and my Reiki lineage is evolutionary Reiki, which is through Divine Mother. And I was led to that. So the missionary story here is, this has all been divine guidance, okay? I had an experience 25 years ago of coming out of a second marriage that was horribly painful and horribly abusive. And I had a profound experience of healing personally, as I was going through that relationship and through that marriage. And that was, again, one of those things where there are soul contracts, there are soul agreements. And I went to God extendedly over a period of time, and I said, I believe through the power of Jesus Christ that the kind of healing that you've blessed me to receive in this certain area of my life is available through Christ, through the power of the atonement. And I want to know how to access it for myself and how to facilitate it for others. They heard me, they took me seriously, and they have led me all along to the modalities that I use. The next one was rapid eye technology. And I was introduced to rapid eye technology, which was brought into the world by a menopausal Mormon woman, a menopausal Mormon Relief Society president,
who received the revelation that was at the heart of Rapid Eye Technology, which if you don't know what it is, it's an eye movement technology, then there's no one like it. There's others that use eye movement, but there's nothing like Rapid Eye Technology. And I was introduced to it by a client who went to Idaho and participated in a workshop with a Rapid Eye practitioner. He came back and told me about it and asked me about it. And in that moment, I got the revelation to say, this is one of the things you need to go learn. So I came to Utah, and I received the training, and I became a Master Rapid Eye practitioner. That was another one. The third major, and I had, there are others that are supplemental, but the third major method that I use is soul detective healing, and that came through a professional association I'm a part of and attending a workshop, and again, receiving a revelation, this is another piece, because as fabulous as Rapid Eye is, it can't do everything. And I'm sorry if there's a Rapid Eye practitioner here, no offense intended, but it can't do everything. As fabulous as it is, soul detective amplified it and took it to a cosmic level and enables me to do work directly at the spiritual level and with generational healing and past lives and beyond. So those are, that's briefly what I use and how I was led to them.
My question is, I also do energy work, Reiki and theta work and such, but I've since left the church, so there's no issue for me. One is they're just, it's all spirituality. But I'm interested in these women that are going and doing these alternative practices and then going and almost living a second life that no one's aware of. What is the desire to stay in a church where you can't express that and you have to hide that part of your spirituality? I'm just wondering what's keeping them, if you've spoken with them, what's keeping them in the church when they're obviously receiving more fulfillment in these experiences that they can't even tell people about, which to me is kind of sad. Are they hoping the church changes someday and allows this? Is that, or are they just somehow splitting their lives?
So it's a mix of things. I do have women that I've interviewed that have said that, like one woman in particular, she said that if she were to resign, her dad would literally die. Literally. He would have a heart attack and he would die. So, I mean, that's, you know, reason for a lot of people to stay and to remain active. There are women that they do hope that the church will change. They have invited other women into the group that meets on Sundays, and other women have come to this group just to kind of give it a scale. There's about 35 women that meet every Sunday, but they do have connections across different cities in Utah that ends up being about 200 to 300 women. So that's quite a few people, and they do invite women from their Relief Society to come and to participate. Also, though, most of the women talk about how Mormonism is, it's their people. You know, the woman who I mentioned who wore her temple dress, a lot of women wear their temple dress to the river, but the woman I particularly talked about, Eliza, she, you know, she's the great-granddaughter of John Taylor. That matters deeply to her, and she can't imagine a world where he would have had so many grandchildren, but she can't imagine a world where one of John Taylor's great-granddaughters isn't an active Mormon. And for her, that deeply matters enough for her to remain active, to have a calling. She goes to the temple all the time. But a lot of the temple actually ends up being a lot of what the women desire and why they stay. Most of the women talk about how they do hold the priesthood when they're in the temple. And for that reason, to be able to continue to go to the temple and to participate specifically in the washing and anointings, most women cite that part of the temple, the initiatories, as what really keeps them active Mormon.
I mean, I could just as easily ask, that's a really good question. But it's kind of like, from my perspective at least, it's kind of like asking, why did that guy go on a mission whose parents left him in the middle of where, Timbuktu? Well, geez, I'd go too. I've just been left in the desert to die, possibly, you know, whatever. Who knows what's going to happen? In the desert, in the summer, by the people who are supposed to love me the most. Damn right I'm going to show up at the MTC tomorrow because I know what the consequences are of not following, you know, the thing, you know. And for many people, I mean, like, I don't suffer from that. I don't have the problem of pioneer ancestry. I'm a 16-year-old convert. I mean, I converted when I was 16. And I was an only child. My parents never converted. So while I really bought it hook, line, and sinker and operated out of, you know, wanting to them to be, you know, Mormonism to be my people, I never had that experience. I don't have that pioneer ancestry. I don't have parents who would die, and all of my children are inactive. The only one who had been married in the temple died, and she hated it.
Well, I'd like to answer that question not from the point of view of a researcher, but from someone who's asked that question, and I do still ask that question. I still do dance with that tension. I joined the church at the beginning of my sophomore year in college after having lived in a small northern Utah farming community that was very cloistered, very closed. To my parents' great dismay and heartbreak. And as I've thought through the years, because this experience, this whole journey of energy healing and spirituality and my professional growth and my professional training, it's all threads of the same thing. It's all interwoven. It's hard to separate it out. This is this, this is that, and this is the other. Okay, and so as I ask myself, why do I still stay engaged? And it's very different than it was 20, 30 years ago. And my involvement has evolved, but I still consider myself a member of the LDS Church. I am a member of the LDS Church. I participate in the ways I choose, and I consciously choose them. And when I ask that question, and my answer is, the deep song of Mormonism, the deep song, the spiritual experience that Joseph had, however, whatever version we believe, however we tell the story, something really happened there. And it changed his life enough that he stood by it the rest of his life. And the deep song of the message of Mormonism is what has empowered me to go on this journey, this idea of eternal progress, that we can, in fact, as audacious as it sounds, become like God, become divine, that we have divinity within us, that the mortal journey is the journey of awakening that, awakening us to our goddesshood. That's a beautiful, beautiful idea. And yes, other people have that. Even other people, other Christianities have that. But I found it in Mormonism. And I still find that incredibly beautiful, incredibly empowering, and incredibly affirming. And I would also say my direct experience with the divine has never been biased. I've never felt treated as less than, put in a box, patronized, told, oh, just go over there and have more babies. I had two. Back in the era when that was radical, okay? I've always been treated as an equal directly by God. And I have conversations with the divine from that point of view. And thirdly, I stay because these are my people. And I feel with all humility that I am called to serve these people in a way that is perhaps unique. And so I stay.
I also want to say that the women who stay in this group, I mean, who stay in the church in this group that we're discussing, the ones who are not staying because they feel like they have to, they'd lose their marriage, they'd lose their children, they'd lose their parents, whatever, they, I suspect, do not feel captive to the institutional. They're like her. They're going to have as many kids as they want, and, you know, to heck with whoever has anything to say about it. They're, you know, they're not afraid, and they are claiming their rights, whatever they feel those are, and claiming those practices that are meaningful to them, And that's fabulous. You know, if it works for them, great. Just choose it.
And I just, because I didn't state it like strongly enough or at all, because man, they know it's true.
Yeah.
Like they know Mormonism's true. And there are women who are part of Community of Christ who join their group sometimes, but yeah, like aside from the ones that do like have fear from certain things, like man, they just know it's true. Like they just know.
I think we have time for one more question.
So we often in the church don't talk about Heavenly Mother, but you guys talk about it all the time, so you're in that, okay. So in what way do you envision Heavenly Father and Heavenly Mother and Jesus? I mean, what's the working relationship, or are they even all three there if is only Heavenly Mother there? Do you see what I mean? What's your sort of idea, your configuration?
I'm Catholic, so I don't have that. We have Mary. She's the Queen of Heaven, the Mother of God, and the Mother of us all, and that's all I got.
I love that question. I love that question because I think where we ultimately need to go is to find some way to recapture the original pattern and the original blueprint of that original partnership. So when you ask me, you know, how do I envision Father God and Mother God and Jesus, and how does this all work with all these three deities?
Oh, put in the Holy Ghost.
Oh, in the Holy Ghost. Okay. Well, first of all, there's a pretty strong argument that the Holy Ghost is female. Okay. There's the partnership, and there's even vestiges and echoes of it in the Old Testament. Now, not in our Old Testament, but in the Catholic Old Testament, there's vestiges in the wisdom books about the role of Divine Mother, and I use that word with caution, but that gives us the beginning glimmers of the partnership. They are partners. The best partners in marriage that you know of are evocative of the partnership between Mother and Father God. Okay? That's how I see that. So, passive and in the kitchen, barefoot and pregnant, eternally, or if you saw the old movie Ants years ago with Woody Allen and the Queen Ant on the little footstool and continually handing off a baby from, you know, to the attendant beside her, continually barefoot, pregnant, and in the kitchen. That is not my vision on the Divine Feminine. And not that creativity in the form of having children and giving is not part of it, but it's so much bigger. It's the energy of creation. So it's incredible hubris to me that any institutional religion can so resolutely ignore her and write her out of the narrative. It's just almost laughable to me that she's out of the narrative. Okay? And then Jesus has his role as Savior. And then, in many people's opinion, there is the Christ Sophia, the female Christ. So there's a heavenly four-person deity. And that's just beginning to be emerging. And if you want to read some things about that, talk to me afterward. I'll give you some things to spark your reading.
You just reminded me, your question just reminded me of several years ago, I can't even remember, sometime in the last 10 years, they published the Joseph Smith Sunday School Manual, you know, the Teachings of the Prophets Manual, and I did an analysis of it, maybe for my dissertation or for some paper or something, and I was struck by the fact that they actually published, and so in some way, some very real way, canonized the part of the King Follett discourse that they actually, you know, that they published in that. That was the King Follett discourse was all over that book, and that manual, that Sunday School manual or Relief Society manual. I'm sorry, is that what it is?
It was the Priesthood Relief Society.
Priesthood Relief. Yeah. Okay. Sorry. See, it's been a long time. Anyway, But I remember looking at that and reading it again, and how incredibly beautiful and lovely that is, the King Follett discourse. And at one point, Joseph says, and the gods were, or God, I can't remember if it said God or the gods, was lonely and wanted to make beings who were equal to him that he could teach what he knew to. That is not what we've got today. That vision is not what is operating today in terms of what we see the godhood, what most Mormons see the godhood as. Me personally, I mean, that's an expansive view of the universe that had me join the church. It's not there now. It's gone, as far as I can see, with most people, unless I hang out with, when I hang out with other people like this. But from my own perspective, I have let go of, of the Christ as Redeemer view of Christ's role. I had a friend who kept arguing with me, you can't have the plan of salvation if you don't have Jesus. And I'm like, yes, you actually can. You can have Christ as the Savior who saves us from our ignorance, who, you know, is our teacher, who, it doesn't have to be someone who saves us from, being human. I mean, we're the same species of God. We're freaking the same species as God. We're not broken. I don't think we're not broken. We make mistakes. If you want to call those sins, you can. But I don't think we need saving in the traditional way that Mormons think about Christ. That's just my, I realize I'm in a very, very small minority. But so I tend to see Christ as someone who shows us the way. I'm sorry? Or is that somebody out there?
Thank you all for coming. We'd like to thank our presenters. Let's give them a round of applause.